recap a couple of things we have seen. I want to have my notes here from the first lecture, and I want to see what did we manage to achieve and what did we leave out, so that I could say a few words about what we left out. Okay. So in these lectures, we studied random walks, and we studied some statistical mechanical models of spins. Concerning spins, we focused mostly on three models. The Ising model, which is the prototypical example of a model with spins, where I have a spin which can take values plus or minus one at each site of a lattice. And we studied the 2D Ising model and the 1D Ising model there at the end. The Gaussian model, which would be one where the spin is instead a continuous label that can take any real value. And the ON model, where the spin is a vector that we decided to say it's in a sphere. So its magnitude is constrained, its direction is not. Then we saw that these models, they actually also admit a nice description, a nice dual description. All these models have dualities. And for example, the Ising model in two dimensions, when we think that we can immediately write it as a sum over configurations of sticks on a lattice, because this exponential is 1 plus v times s I s j. So either I take 1 or I take v. So either I put nothing between a link or I put a stick. And the weight is just 1, right, times v to the number of sticks. So that's a duality with a model of sticks. In the same way, the Gaussian model, if I expand, now I don't have just s I s j. I can have any power of s I j or s j, which means that I can have no stick or 1 stick or 2 sticks or 3 sticks. No stick, 1 stick, 2 sticks, 3 sticks. And when we expand the exponential for link ij, we get 1 over nij factorial, which is the statement that the sticks are indistinguishable. And we get an ni factorial, where I is the number of sticks that meet at position I, which is nice because it has this interpretation that if I have, say, 4 sticks, if I want to think of this as paths, there are 3 ways of recombining them, and that's what we get when we plug the correct expression after I fix these typos there, right? When we correct the 3 double factorial, that's exactly what we get. What about the ON model? In the ON model, same business. We could expand. As we expand down, we get j to the number of sticks. Sticks are still indistinguishable. But now the weight would be something more complicated that would be related to the average of spin at position to the spin to a given power ni. And that one is what it is. Then we went further and said that, by the way, this one here, the Gaussian model, say, precisely because you have this nice factor of recombinations, you can indeed think of these sticks as paths. And you are summing over paths, connected and disconnected. So it's the exponential of a single connected path with a 1/2, because you can have one orientation or another orientation, and that will cancel the 1/2. And therefore, you would get a very simple expression like this. And so we would say that there is a connection between unrestricted random walks, here any random walk, and the Gaussian model. What about in the Ising model? In the Ising model, we don't have these recombination factors. We have 1 for each configuration of sticks. But we saw that we could also write it as a very similar sum, provided we put a minus 1 to the winding of the path. Because this, for example, made this 3 into a 1, right? So we had 3, and we had 1 plus 1 minus 1. We end up getting 1, OK? What about in the ON model? In the ON model, we get an interpretation in terms of paths in this funny limit, where we take the number of components of our vector to go to 0, right? It's kind of an unusual limit, right? Because we started n components, and we send the number of components to 0. That is a bit weird from the point of view of the first starting point, right? Because I'm integrating over n-dimensional vectors. From the point of view of the model with sticks, n appears here as a parameter, right, in these weights. So at this point, it's OK. It's a partition function of sticks. It depends on n. N can be whatever parameter. At this point, it's OK to take n to 0, right? N was already integrated. The spins were already integrated out when I went to this language of sticks. And then we saw that because n goes to 0, things like this are actually forbidden. things like this don't happen. They go to they vanish when n goes to zero, and we get a sum over self-avoiding walks, walks that will not touch, of and so there would be a connection between the O0 model and the theory of self-avoiding walks. In the Ising model, we also said, even though we did not compute, or first let's say in the Gaussian model, we computed the correlation function of two spins. We saw that it decays exponentially with distance with some correlation length. Unless you tune the correlation length to infinity, which is unless you tune some mass to zero, that is, unless you tune some temperature to the critical temperature. And in that case, they decay as a power law, 1 over the distance to the power d minus 2. Okay? Which is just, if you want, dimensional analysis. We just had a Fourier integral, e to the I k r over k square. So by dimensions, this has units d minus 2, right? In k, and therefore in r, it's 1 over d minus 2. And so we get a power law behavior when we are at a critical temperature. So correlation lengths are infinity and things decay as a power law. That also happens in the Ising model if I am exactly at the critical temperature, also when the correlation length blows up. But instead of giving a power zero, which is a log, I get a power 1/4. So we said that this model is not a small deviation from the Gaussian model. It's really either zero or 1/4. It's far away. Otherwise, in two dimensions, if we are below the critical temperature, there is a magnetization. If we are above, there's no magnetization. And at very large distance, if I subtract the magnetization, it also decays as an exponential where this correlation length blows up as I approach the critical temperature. This one here would be another critical exponent. What about in one dimension? In one dimension, there's no magnetization ever, so it just decays. Indeed, we can see that Si, Sj is a ratio of the two eigenvalues of our two transfer matrix. That's how we solved this Ising model. We just wrote a simple 2x2 transfer matrix. And it's all about computing its eigenvalues. The ratio of eigenvalues is related to the correlation length. And the largest eigenvalue dominates the partition function. Right? So and that's a usual lesson, which is that often you can solve problems by transfer matrix methods, and it's often the case that the largest eigenvalue dominates the most obvious quantities you want to study, and then the sub-leading eigenvalue is relevant for correlation lengths and for fluctuations around that leading configuration. So typically, the two leading eigenvalues of the matrix are the important ones. Okay? And here, we have no order. Whereas here, we could have order if we are below TC, right? So we asked whether can one have order? And here, we have some discrete symmetry. And we see that in D equals 1, we know it's not possible. In D equals 2, it is possible. In D bigger than 2, it's also possible. And this was also something very important that we saw. How did we establish this table? We studied entropy versus energy. So we studied entropy versus energy, or energy versus entropy, in various dimensions, D. We saw that the difference of energy, if you have a local model, there is some local delta energy, which is order 1. And that was key in estimating the energy of a given configuration. It's proportional to the area that separates the two domains. We also computed the entropy. And we saw who wins. And we saw that we can have a competition in two dimensions, but the entropy always wins in one dimension. And so in one dimension, it's always better to create many domains, because it costs almost no energy. It's order 1 to create a domain. And you get entropy that scales with the length of with the number of possibilities of where do I put it. And so we say that in one dimension, these domains, we think of them in one dimension. We have all plus, and then suddenly we have all minus. We think of this as a kink. And we say that kinks destroy order in D equals 1. Okay. Then we also asked what would happen if I have a continuous symmetry. And then, of course, if you cannot have order in one dimension, you cannot have order even if it's continuous. But in D equals 2, you can also not have order even when the symmetry is continuous, because this difference of energy that was before of order 1 will become of order 1 over L squared if the symmetry is continuous. Because we could simply change the spins over a domain. This would be like a domain wall here. And we would slowly change it. So there is the difference in spins, which is of order 1 over L, if my barrier is of order, is a thickness of order L. And because up has the same energy as right, the difference of energy is of order 1 over L squared. Right? And therefore, once I integrate over a barrier which has some thickness of order L and some length of order L, L times L is L squared times 1 over L squared gives me some total energy of order 1, but the entropy was scaling like L, so the entropy always wins in two dimensions. We also saw this in another way, and this was related to if you have a symmetry that is broken, then it leads to massless modes. That's Goldstone's theorem, because if you have a symmetry that is broken, it shows one direction, but you could choose another one that is nearby, and the energy cost to go from this to this is zero, because it was a symmetry. And so this mode has no mass, it has no gap, right? Because you go smoothly from one configuration to the other at no energy cost. But massless particles are pathological in two dimensions. They grow, their correlations grow. So these massless modes, they are bad in D equals 2, right? And therefore, we conclude that symmetry is not broken. Right? If it was, it would reach a contradiction. Right? We also said differently. We said, assuming symmetry is broken, then we said that the magnetization would be some M0 plus some small correction. But then we computed this small correction. This small correction was infinite, and therefore it was not small, and therefore the symmetry was not broken. Right? We expanded around the spin and we saw that this could not happen. So this is a very important table that gives us some idea of what can happen in various models and various dimensions.
Can you repeat the argument about why energy change in energy is of order 1 over L squared? Why didn't follow it?
Well, there are many ways of seeing it. So first of all, in the concrete example that we have, the energy is S dot Si dot Sj, right? So it wants to have them aligned up, right? So we have a spin up, and the other one is rotated a bit. And so this guy, this second spin, is equal to the first spin plus a perpendicular correction. But because it's perpendicular, this vector dot this vector is zero to leading order. And so it's a second order effect. So it's not 1 over L, it's 1 over L squared. Another way of saying is I was at the minimum. And because I'm at the minimum, the expansion is second order because I'm at the minimum of energy. And that's the geometrical way of saying that I'm at the minimum. More questions? Okay, so something very important that we also saw, let me. Was the idea of renormalization. So we have this idea of renormalization group. And in this example, for example, we said that if I start with the Ising model with some coupling J, then there were two steps. One step is I integrate things out, and now I get a new coupling J prime. And then for comparison, I rescale things such that my fundamental scale is 1 again. And so this would be 1 RG step. And once we do this, we got the equation. In terms of V, it was trivial, but V is tangent. So we can write that J prime is equal to arc tangent of tangent of J square, right? Because the equation was V prime equal V square, right? And V is just tangent of J. So we get this type of equation, okay? That, okay, which is, as I said, equivalent to just V prime equal to V square, where V is tangent of J. And this equation is such that this equation looks like this. Let's say in V, but you can also do it in J, right? For J small, this is J square. And then when J is very big, it... It would blow up, yeah. So go like this. Arc, who's... Okay, well, let me do it here. It's easier. It's the same. 1, 1, this is V, V prime. And we saw that if we start at any value smaller than 1, we end up converging towards V equals 0, which is high temperature. And so we got this RG picture that is, if you study the model, I study the model with some microscopic detail, and I get some coupling. You study with a cutoff that is 5 times bigger, right? And it's the same model. It is just that your microscope is not good enough. So you see 5 steps when I see, you see 1 step when I see when I could see the 5 steps inside that, and your coupling is much smaller. And so the same model, as I zoom out, is effectively described by a system where this coupling is becoming smaller and smaller. The spins are therefore becoming totally decoupled, and therefore we would be in the paramagnetic domain. And whereas 1 would be the ferromagnetic domain, which is not physically accessible because you would need temperature to be exactly 0. Or V to be exactly 1, or J to be exactly infinity. So just to give an intuitive example, in 2D, we did not do this exercise because we solved the model exactly instead, right? But in 2D, what we would expect is something. In 2D, what happens? As I start renormalizing, we saw in 2D, we integrate out, and then we generate new couplings. And so we have two options. One option is, can we try to find a clever grid where this doesn't happen, where the grid doesn't have so many neighbors, and as I'm integrating out, I'm staying in the model which looks like what I had before I integrate out, like in the 1D model, right? Some clever triangular lattice or something that is not the square lattice where that doesn't work. So that's perhaps true. Or we stay with the lattice, we truncate to a given number of couplings, and we study that subspace of couplings, and we ignore the other ones, and we hope it's more or less okay. And what we would do in that case, we expect something like this, where, let me draw first the line J, and we would expect something like this, where now, if I start, now I would have some critical V, some critical coupling, and depending on whether I am above or below this critical coupling, I would flow to a trivial ferromagnetic or to a trivial antiferromagnetic, and this would be a critical point that we computed, and we know that this is 1 plus square root of 2. Was it 1 plus square root of 2? No, I'm confusing. Maybe it was something else. Square root of 2 minus 1?
Yes.
Square root of 2 minus 1. Okay? And then and that would be the kind of picture we would get if we had solved the model by RG with some approximation scheme. That matches the exact solution that we solved there. That there is some critical temperature, and depending on whether I am above or below, I have magnetization equal to zero, magnetization not equal to zero on one side, and some critical temperature in the middle where the correlation length would blow up. Yes?
Can you explain the flow via your staircase sort of thing in the first diagram?
Here?
Yeah.
So I start with some value V, and I go to this V prime. Now I start with this V prime and repeat the game. So it's very convenient to draw this line. That's the line V prime equal V. Because starting with this value and trying again, a way to do it graphically is just you shoot until you hit this line and you come back. So this step, doing this, means take this value and repeat again. So you start with some V and you go to some V prime. And now you say, take this V prime and go to V prime prime. The way to do it graphically is like this, because you are here at this value, and you want to start at this value, which is here, but in this axis here.
Okay.
So you shoot to this line and you go down, now you are at the right value. Okay, and then you go up to that value there. Right? So this is just a way of going from this axis to this axis. Just put a mirror there. Okay, so now you are here, V prime, and you get this value, V prime prime. Now you want to repeat again to start here at V prime prime. How do? You shoot here so that you are at V prime prime and you go up there. Okay? So that's how we would iterate these equations. Okay, good. We also saw then we analyzed random walks on their own. And we studied four types of random walks. Four types of random walks. Unrestricted random walks first, biased random walks, winding random walks, and self-avoiding walks. And when we had these walks, there was something interesting going on. You could also do renormalization. You could also take a walk, zoom out, so that this becomes one step, this becomes one step, this becomes one step, this becomes one step. And then after you make these steps, you shrink them again so that they have the typical length scale being 1 again. Okay, here it doesn't look like I shrunk it, but I should have shrunk it so that this step would be 1 again. And then you would do it several times. And you would also flow, and you would flow to a Gaussian probability delta r. And so we start with a complicated probability distribution at the UV, and we go to this Gaussian model. Unless you started with a small bias, like here, that it's slightly more likely to go to the right. And then as you coarse grain, the paths become like this, and you continue coarse graining, and they become flatter and flatter if I would have a bias. We even saw it in a very simple formula that illustrated, if I compute the average displacement square, then I take the square root to define some kind of R bar, some average size of the random walk. Then if I have a very small bias, this is the plot that I would get for R0 very small. I have a bias, but it's very small. Then my expectation value, my size, starts as a square root. In other words, I don't see the bias at very small times, at large times, but much smaller than R0. But eventually, I go to a behavior that where the bias is important, right? In other words, if I'm really zooming in here, I don't see that there is a bias, right? I need to zoom out to start seeing that there is a bias. Okay? What about in a self-avoiding walk? In a self-avoiding walk, it was more interesting. It was not just power one half and power one. We got the power nu in the self-avoiding walk. And this nu was one in the equals one. It was 3/4 in the equals two. It was approximately equal to 0.59 in the equals three. And it was 1/2 for the bigger or equal than four. And let me remind you that there also we did some RG in going saying that this path, for example, from as I zoom out, they become a fundamental step of going up by one step, whereas this was one step. In other words, first I coarse grain, then I shrink again so that they have the same step one. And in this way, if I started with a sum of z to the number of steps, I go after RG to a sum of a coupling z prime to the number of steps, where this z prime was given by something like this, as in that example of the 2D Ising model, meaning that there is a critical point, z critical, that is equivalent, as we said, to studying long walks. And then there is a flow to boring, to more boring points. Here it's a flow to z equals zero to small walks. And here it would be a flow to z equal infinity, which would be space filling walks. This was an approximation, but it did give us some reasonable exponent. If we zoom in here, we computed nu and we got 0.715, which is not so bad. So this was an approximation, right? Because we ignored the fact that we could generate new couplings. So we get plus new couplings. And we just ignored it. And so it was an approximation, and indeed the result was not perfect. And then, finally, yesterday, we saw that there was an argument by Flory that said that this nu could be related by 3 over d plus 2. We could find it by fighting against thinking of a big polymer and fighting its energy versus its entropy, right? And when we said this, we estimated the energy by saying it's related to the concentration of the polymer square. We estimated its entropy. We said, let's assume it's like the entropy of a random walk, how many ways there are to put the path. We ask how the two fight. How does the entropy fight with this energy of repulsion? And we saw that there was an equilibrium point that fixes R to be n to the 3 over d plus 2. When we thought we estimated the energy, we estimated the entropy, and the fight between the two gave us this exponent. And this exponent is pretty spectacular because it almost agrees with all these points. So if we plot, let's try to to plot what we get. Let's put here the dimension, d, 1, 2, 3, 4. In d equals 1, I get 1, that's ballistic, that's okay. In d equals 2, I get 3/4, that's okay. In d equals 3, I get 0.6. And in d equals 4, we get 1/2. which is the usual random walk. And therefore, and in general, this curve of Flory, it's some curve that passes by this point, and this point. But then we said that actually there's something we can do. We can zoom in here and explore the duality of these self-avoiding walks with the O0, with the O(n) going to 0 model. And we could use it to extract from the O0 model what this dimension should be close to d equals 4. And then we knew that the correct result is not Flory's result, but it's slightly down, right? So nu that I extract from On would be 1/2 minus plus epsilon over 16, where epsilon is this separation here. Whereas the one that I would get from Flory would be 1/2 plus epsilon over 12. So it's a bigger quantity. And that is kind of in line with the expectation. So it means that the line should not go, come up as much. It should come up a bit lower. So you could guess that perhaps the exact result is somewhere here. And this would be the 0.59 instead of the 0.6. Okay, and that would be the correct result. Somewhere the curve should be a little bit smaller. Although, nicely, the curve gets this right, and this right. But this one almost right. But not completely right. Okay. And we did it in also from an RG point of view, considering directly the RG in the continuum. What was the last very important idea that that we wrote here? So what were the key ideas that we said we were going to see? We said that we're going to see that we have a lattice, and therefore we don't have infinities if we know what we are doing. And that we saw all our RGs were finite, right? And we were just from some coupling to some coupling Z primes. There were no infinities floating around. The only time we got an infinity was here, but we said that infinity is not infinity. It's the size of the system. Because if we have a Brillouin zone, that small momenta was L. It was not infinity. And so having a lattice and having all these RG examples that we did for random walks, but also for spin models and so on, it's very good, I think, conceptually, because it helps separate this idea of RG, which is you zoom out and you see what new couplings you get. You zoom out and you see what's the physics at lower energy or larger distances, from technicalities of field theory of how do we deal with infinities and how do we renormalize directly in the continuum. And conceptually, this way of thinking is totally correct. The infinities are something that one has, it's an extra complication that in practice that should not complicate our physical picture. RG was another very important concept. And within RG, and related to RG, and to this business of lattices, was the idea of universality. Was the idea that there are many things that we do in the UV that don't matter at large distances. So here, for example, we could say that I have the Gaussian model, and I have couplings between nearest neighbors. Right? And we could say plus, and we could times, and we could put here other couplings. Right? Between next to nearest neighbors, for example. Right? We could put other couplings, ij, between, say, next to nearest neighbors. What would it change? Nothing. It would have some sticks that would now be nearest neighbors and next to nearest neighbors. There will be some of walks that instead of going just one step, can go one step or two steps. And then at large distances, the walks are all universal. These correlation functions are all universal. And it would change a little bit the form of this correlation length, but nothing would change. Right? So these details of in the short distance, are there just nearest neighbors or nearest neighbors and next to nearest neighbors? Is it a square lattice? Is it a diagonal lattice? It doesn't matter. So these details doesn't matter, provided you don't change too much. Of course, if instead of having a local coupling, you start saying that spin I couples with a spin which is very far away, now it can start to matter. Right? And you can ask, what does it mean? For example, if I say that my coupling between neighbors is 5, And then between next nearest neighbor is 3. And it decreases. Does it matter or not? Well, then it depends how fast does it decrease, right? If it decreases very fast, then it's basically local. Even if I couples with any j, but if the coupling between I and j decays with the distance fast enough, in practice, it's as if it was local. But if it decreases very slowly, if spin I couples with spin j and the coupling decreases very slowly, then it could matter at large distances, right? And so we have this picture. And so we have this picture that we can have various lattices. So this is one lattice. This is the same lattice plus another coupling. This could be a different lattice, L prime. This could be L with a coupling JIJ that as I minus J increases, the coupling decreases very fast, so that here it's very small. And all these guys would flow at large distance. They would flow to the same Gaussian model universality class. Right? But then, for example, if you consider one where the spins decay but slower, it could flow to a different theory. Right? I have a priori no guarantee. So if now it decays much slower, then I could eventually have some different large distance behavior. It could be more interesting. If now the couplings are not just nearest neighbors, then some, it's not like I can do anything, right? Right? Similarly, yes?
So, is there some kind of a boundary between what distinguishes, between what is very weak coupling or what is strong coupling? So,
yeah.
Since if I have a model, so...
For example, if I say that my spins I and j, if they decay with some power of distance, I minus j to some power r, there will be some r, critical r, where... If R is bigger than that critical R, it decays very fast and I'm on this side. As soon as R passes by that critical value, I start flowing to another class of models, for example. So R would be really a sharp boundary between the two.
But how do we find that R critical, for instance? That is kind of...
It's hard. Typically, it's very hard. Numerics. You'd come up with an exactly solvable example, perhaps in one dimension first to get some experience. Right, in 1D, we could try to come up with a model in one dimension. Right? Yeah. So for example, even in one dimension, you could have a coupling between spin I and spin I plus N. That would be 1 over N to some power. And it is known that if N is bigger than 2, that it is as if it was localizing model. The physics at large distances. But if n is smaller than 2, it's known to be different. So 1 over distance square in one dimension is the boundary between the two. But typically, you cannot solve. But for example, in one dimension, I know that if the coupling between spin I and spin j in one dimension, imagine I have a coupling jij. That is, as we said, 1 over I minus j to some power r. Then I'm telling you that if r is bigger than 2, that's equivalent in practice to the same type of model when I couples with I plus 1. It's effectively local. But if r is smaller or equal than 2, then this is what are called long-range Ising models. And that's in a different universality class. And typically, it's hard to solve. If you put there r cube, it's hard to solve this model. Or if you put r square, it's also hard to solve this model. But you could imagine that perhaps there are some potentials that you could solve this model exactly and use it as a playground. For example, I think if Jij is log of 1 plus a square over I minus j square, I think this model is solvable. And you see, it's a nice potential that when I minus j is very large, it decays as 1 over I minus j square. And when I minus j is order 1, it's some number of order 1. So it's some function that decays with the right behavior. But this, for example, turns out to be exactly solvable, I think, this example. So we can use this example to gain some intuition about this transition between one universality class and another. OK, this is a parenthesis. Now, what other models would also flow to this? For example, I could imagine that I start already with a Gaussian model plus some very shallow potential that does almost nothing. Right? It's a very shallow potential that is doing almost nothing. Then, at large distance, I still flow to the Gaussian model. But now, suppose I start with a Gaussian model plus some potential that is not very shallow. That says that instead of integrating from minus infinity to plus infinity with a Gaussian distribution, by putting this potential, I'm effectively now integrating over configurations close to minus 1 or close to plus 1. Those are the ones that dominate. Now what would happen? Now I would flow to the Ising model universality class. To the Ising model type family. Right? Because now I'm effectively integrating over spins that are all either in one minimum of the potential or in the other. So it's like summing over spin, which is plus 1 or minus 1. Similarly, I could start with Ising. And I start with Ising, and of course, I flow to the Ising model at large distance. By that, I mean to this large distance behavior. And I could start with Ising, right? With Ising plus some other couplings. Some S, I, S, J, next to nearest neighbors. And I would also flow to the same thing. Right? And so we have these various models, and I could start with a lattice gas. And the lattice gas is in the same universality of this spin model, so I also flow to the same thing, like we said before. And so we have different models in the UV, many different models. Sometimes it's obvious which one I flow, which one I don't flow. Sometimes it's not so obvious, like in this potential, being shallow versus being deep. Where exactly is the transition? Being local or being not local, where exactly is the transition? Sometimes it's not obvious which universality class I will go. But that's the general picture. In general, you expect that there are families, different universality classes down here, a bunch, not that many. There are a few ones down here. And you flow to those independent of the complications that you can have in the UV. So that was a very important idea of universality. And the fact that you start here, and there are many directions, the fact that these directions don't matter, that starting here, here, or here is the same, the fact that these directions don't matter in that sense, is the statement of this so-called irrelevant operators or irrelevant effects, which is the statement that there are many extra terms that you can add that have no effect at large distances. And most are like that. So most things that you add at large distances, they give the same physics, but at short distances, of course, they matter a lot. If I have a triangular lattice or a square lattice, when I zoom in a microscope, I see beautiful triangles or beautiful squares. So of course, it's different. But when I zoom out, I see the same kind of power law correlation length and so on if I'm at a critical point. OK, so I think these were the main things. So now let's see what did we not cover in the that we discussed in the very first lecture. So this was what we did see. So in the first lecture, I first started saying that we will do random walks, various types of random walks. Some random walks that I did not write there were these never look back random walks, when I have like some plant that is living, right, like this. And you could imagine some random walk like this. You could even imagine doing a generalization of what we did in the lecture by adding gravity. And imagine that not only I sum over the walks, but it costs more energy to go up there than it costs to be down here. So the paths want to fall, right? And this was in the tutorial yesterday, for example, some example of imagine you have a plant that is growing in between two walls and it grows, but there's gravity, so it typically wants to be closer to the floor more than it wants to go up, right? Like a plant goes here. But if gravity is very strong, it will be squeezed to the ground all the time, right? And if there is no gravity, it's floating here, half of the time's up, half of the time's down, right? And there are these nice models that this was, for example, in the tutorial, where we would study these models. In fact, in the tutorial, the model was that the plant could only move, was restricted, so it could either go down here or go up here. So it was simpler, it was either up or down. This is a more interesting model, where you start here and you can just fall down. That one is harder. To my knowledge, it's not solvable. It's not solved. You can almost solve it, but the last step, I don't know how to solve, but it's a nice model. So you have this nice random walks. This ON model we saw. So now there was something that you saw in the tutorial that I would like to say a few words, because this was a model. This is a very rich model that we did not have much time to study. And that's the O2 model. Okay. So we studied the O0 model, and in the lecture you studied the O2 model. So the O2 model is one where our vector S is just some really basically some angle, right? Because it's a unit vector with two components. So it's basically just some cosine theta, sine theta. And therefore, we have at each position of some lattice, let's say we are doing in two dimensions, we have some angle, we have some angle theta at each side. And so the scalar product S dot S is just cosine of theta minus theta prime. And so our Hamiltonian is the sum over neighbors I and j, sum coupling j times cosine of theta I minus theta j. And so the minimum, H minimum, is given when all spins are pointing in the same direction, right? When theta I equal to constant. Let's put a minus sign so that it's the minimum. In the lectures, you might have noticed that typically we say it's e to the partition function is e to the minus h, and then I think most of the time I just ignored that minus. I wrote h and then I wrote partition function e to the h, right? So I think probably always in the lecture I was just writing always minus h, right? Because I was writing what is in the exponent all the time. I was never, right? I wrote several times h is equal to that, and then that's what I put in the exponent. So I was never putting a different sign for h and for the exponent. It was always the same. Okay, so So the spins want to be all aligned. And so we could ask, is this what happens? Are the spins going to be all aligned? And the answer is no. We know this is not true because in two dimensions, we don't have order. Because it costs very little, it's very easy to have a configuration where here inside the domain, all spins are indeed aligned. But here outside, they are all aligned in a different direction. And here, they are all aligned in a different direction. And there is a transition region that costs very little energy. And therefore, these things would destroy, these domain walls would destroy order. Okay? Nonetheless, and you see that one way of seeing is that this configuration, I can smoothly rotate it to this. Now, a hint that there could be something special is, suppose I have a configuration where the spins were to behave like this. So you see that locally, if you zoom in here, right? So this, locally, it looks like all are pointing in the same direction. All in the vacuum, right? They're all in the minimal energy. And that is what you see if you go here, if you go here, it all looks good. But I cannot deform this configuration smoothly into a configuration where everyone is pointing up, right? There is no way of smoothly taking this configuration and turning it up. Because imagine I start doing it and I decide that I rotate, say, clockwise all the spins, right? Then at some point, there must be a big jump. I cannot. If I start rotating them clockwise, I get a... At some point, it doesn't work. It doesn't merge nicely, right? Because at infinity, all spins are pointing up. But here, all spins are pointing down. Right. So here, half of space is pointing out, half of space is pointing up. It's not like I can smoothly rotate all over half of space. That costs lots of energy. And so these excitations, they would not never show up if I start with a configuration where all spins are up. Then the spins could move a little bit, but they would not create these kind of excitations that are called vortices. Because these excitations, they cost lots of energy. You can estimate the energy of this configuration, right? You can estimate the energy of this configuration. And the energy of this configuration scales like logarithm of the size of the system. You integrate, if you go up to some size L, then the energy inside the box of size L of such configuration scales like logarithm of L. Okay? It's easy to see intuitively what's going on. The further you go, the slowest the spins are changing. So you are integrating something whose derivative decreases with distance, right? And so you are integrating something that is smaller and smaller. And if you see how small does it decrease with distance, the energy density, it decreases with 1 over the radius. And the integral of 1 over the radius gives a log. Okay? Yes?
You must have a singularity in the center, right?
No, because I'm in a lattice, right?
Oh, right, it's a lattice.
These are 4 sides, the spins are.
This looks a lot like the infinite wire, a charge in infinite wire, right? We also get that the potential is a log r.
Yes.
When you take the derivative.
Exactly. 1 over r. That's right. That's a good point. So that looks like the potential of a wire that would be perpendicular to the blackboard, and the particles are in 2 dimensions. Exactly. Then it will have some energy logarithm of r. And so we could ask whether, even though there is no topological order, whether these vortices could appear sometimes and give some interesting physics. Now, one vortex by itself cannot appear. Because if I have one vortex, it costs this very big energy, logarithmic of L. But what you can do is you can have a vortex and an anti-vortex. So there are configurations where if I go around, what is a vortex? It's a configuration where the spin winds in one direction as I go around. And an anti-vortex would be a configuration where the spin winds in an opposite direction as I go around. So I'm not sure I'll be able to draw it, but I can try. So one is like this hedgehog, so, and the other one looks more like something like this. Where is it? All spins would be up here, all will be down here, but okay, I cannot, yeah.
Another one with all
Yeah, it's okay. And then here. Okay, I forgot the picture, but
total divergence
would be kind of zero. Forgot the picture, so the spins go down, go up. And I want to put something down here. Let me see. Yeah, is it just reversing the spins? Maybe it is just reversing the spins.
Because we need the divergence to be zero, so whatever.
That's right. Good, good. Okay, yes. So there is another configuration where the spins are reversed. And you see that if I put one on one here, right? No, there's something wrong.
No need to reverse the spins. Just there's right-handed and then left-handed.
Yeah, you mirror the imagery.
Yeah, the mirror. The mirror of this graph is another anti-vortex.
That's right. So let's see. Mm-hmm.
This one should be rotating the other counterclockwise.
Yeah.
Right now, or the clockwise. So you just mirror everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I don't remember the picture, so let me not draw it. But let me say that there exist configurations that are vortices, there are configurations that are anti-vortices, in the sense that I can have the following. So if I have a vortex and if I have an anti-vortex, let's put a bar here, then far away the spins can all be pointing in the same direction. So far away, I don't see the effect. It's like having electron and proton. Far away, it's neutral. And far away, all spins can be up. Right? But here, I have a vortex. And here, I have an anti-vortex. Right? And so we could imagine, could this vortice and antivortices be important? Okay. So what could we do? We could go and suppose that this theta changes slowly from I to I plus 1. So my action is approximately equal to the integral of the gradient square of theta. Right? I just expand theta around theta I is equal to theta j. So the action is basically the derivative square. Right? But now, I have to be careful. I keep in mind that theta is an angle. Theta is periodic. Theta changes slowly. And I look for configurations where theta is a sum over I of some f of x and y corresponding to putting a vertex at some position xi plus some sum of some f bar that is a function of x and y. X and y now are the position on the lattice in the continuum limit corresponding to an anti-vertex at position x bar I. Okay? And now, what are these? These are solutions to these equations of motion. I write the equations of motion. So these, guys, are solutions to the equations of motion, Navla squared theta equal to 0, with boundary conditions that say that I have some winding with winding around the point xi. Like I would solve for the wire, like you were saying, for the wire I solve Maxwell equations in the vacuum with the condition that if I measure the charge around the wire, I get the right charge. And that tells me that it should be logarithm of x minus xi close to each point where I have this charge. Exactly the same thing here. In fact, it's not a coincidence. This model is dual to the model of Maxwell theory. And now that I write this, then I plug this action here, and I would get some Hamiltonian that would depend now on these positions, xi of the vertices and xi bar of the antivertices. Right? And what would this model be? Well, this model would be the integral over, so each vertex, let's say that the pairs will interact, sum over all pairs I and j. I integrate over the position xi, I integrate over the position xj, over all possible pair vertex antivertex. And then well, vertex can actually interact also with vertex. So let's just put dxi, dxj, and say these are all possible pairs I and j. And then there is some vorticity qi, where this qi would be plus one for a vortex and minus one for an antivortex, qi, and then some potential, which is exactly this potential of the wire, xi minus xj times qj. And so what would happen if this idea is correct, that although we cannot have order, we could imagine having this gas of vortices, then the idea would be that at low energy, the XY model would be dual to this gas of charged particles that interact with this Coulomb interaction. So that was one of the dualities that I mentioned in the beginning. And this would establish this duality between this O2 model and the Coulomb gas. How did we establish this duality? By going to a expanding not around the configuration where we have order, because that we know order is not going to be preserved, it's going to be destroyed, but we expanded around a configuration of vortices. And we got that the picture led to a Coulomb gas picture. Now, we could do something else, and that's what you did in the two tutorials, so let me remind you. You could start with the O2 model, and you could find a duality between to a model of random surfaces, which was another thing that we said that we could try to see in these lectures. So let me just summarize how this step went. So here, we explore this idea of universality to say that right, e to the minus j sum of cosine of theta. Okay, this is our Boltzmann weight for each link ij. For theta very small, right? So this behaves as e to the minus j theta square over 2 for theta very small. But it also behaves like this for theta close to 2 pi, and for theta close to 4 pi, and for theta close to 6 pi, and so on. So close to each minima, it behaves like this. So we said, why don't we replace this by a sum over n, e to the minus j theta minus 2 pi n square over 2. It has the same behavior close to each of the minima, by definition, right? Because close to each of the minima, the potential is it will be a Gaussian close to each of the minima. And you can indeed plot this function and plot this function, and you see that they have the same plot. This function is almost the same as this. Now, this is not exactly equal to this, but it's approximately equal. And in the spirit of universality, we would say that the two models at large distances will flow to the same thing, because they are basically the same potential. You really plot this function, right? You plot this function, j cos theta is some cosine, And if you plot log of this function, you get some function that looks the same. Right? So this is a, here I'm plotting log of this Boltzmann weight. And so they look the same. And so we imagine that at large distance they lead to the same thing. Any question? And therefore, and then there was a nice trick that we did. We said, let's do this trick. Let's replace this by this expression. For each link ij, our energy is a product over all ij. And for each ij, let's use this. And then our partition function becomes, there was an integral product of theta, an integral over each theta. And then now we have a summation for each link I sum over nij, right there, that goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. Okay, so nij, that is an integer number. Product over I and j, e to the minus theta I minus theta j minus 2 pi n I j square over 2 with a j. And so we start with a model. Now, naively, we just complicated the model, right? Because now we had a simple model, and now we have this extra stuff with the sum over with a sum over these extra particles. Right? But then we realize that this summation over n, that we could write this, and this was what's called Poisson resummation formula. That we could write this as a sum over n e to the minus n square over 2j plus I n theta. And now, why do we like this better than that? Because now it's linear in theta, this expression, right? So when I plug it here, the theta dependence here now becomes totally linear in the exponent. So I can just integrate out exactly the thetas. And in this way, I get a partition function that is, so now the thetas, we do the integral over the theta, and we get a partition function as a sum over all these integers nij. And at the end of the day, we got, and this is what you did in the tutorial, I'm just summarizing, e to the minus 1 over 2j ni minus nj square. Well, what is this ni and then, so here now I have a sum over ni. So there are two steps in going from this equality to this. We integrate over thetas. And the integration over thetas, this tells us that the sum over j over n I j equal to 0, right? Because I'm integrating over theta, so it says that whatever multiplies theta must be 0. And theta I appears in n I j, n I k, n I l, n I m, in all the n i's that couple to theta I. And so in total, it tells me that the total sum of these ni's must be equal to 0. And there is a way of making sure that I choose integers that obey these conditions, which is to say that if I think that this is nij, this is nik, this is nil, this is nim, so this is I, this is j, this is k, this is l, this is m. And I want to make sure that the sum over this integer plus this integer plus this integer plus this integer is equal to 0. And the trick is to say, to associate some integer ni here some integer, sorry, some integer n j, some integer well, let's call it differently. N A, N B, N C, and N D, and say that each N, when I have an N associated to this link, that is N I J, if here I have N A and N B, that this guy is N A minus N B. With this definition, that I go to the dual lattice and I associate an integer to each face, and then to each edge I associate the difference of integers, automatically I trivialize this constraint. And therefore, summing over integers with this constraint is the same as summing over integers without constraint of this action here. Okay? Now, this was what you saw in the tutorial. So I'm doing it a bit fast because this was the tutorial. Okay? But what do we conclude here? What is this model? This model is a model where now you see that at each position of my lattice, I have an integer. That's like the height of some surface. And the integer at face I wants to be the same as the integer at face J. Otherwise, there is some energy cost. And so I think of it as a bunch of plaquettes that can be up or down, but they want to be more or less all the same. But they could fluctuate. And it would be, again, a question of who wins. Does the surface want to fluctuate so the entropy wins? Or does it want to be flat such that the energy wins? Right? And it is a game, and it's an interesting statistical model. And indeed, depending on J, there is a transition between smooth surfaces dominating or very rough surfaces dominating. Okay? And so we went to this model of random surfaces where we have an integer Ni belonging to Z at each position of the surface. Right? So this duality here, there is an approximation, which is we replace cosine of theta by some periodic function that looks like similar to cosine of theta. And then we establish this duality. And here there was an approximation in the sense that we made a guess for what type of configurations dominate low energy. And then after we made that guess, we established this duality. Then there is one more thing you can do. You can go to this, you can use this as a starting point for your random surfaces. And in another tutorial, you show that this model, if you massage it a bit, you can go to a Coulomb gas. This was another tutorial. Right? So this was one tutorial, and this was another tutorial. Right? And this going from random surfaces to Coulomb gas, the idea was that you start with this sum, you introduce some, you replace the sum over, you use a trick to replace the summations over n by an integral with an infinite sum of delta functions that implement the sum over n. So you write an integral and you put a sum, an infinite sum of delta functions. So you introduce a new field to do this trick of summing over the integer I. And then you get rid of the ni and you are left with a field, with the other field. Once you do those manipulations, you end up exactly with that action there at the very end of the Coulomb gas. And so from here to here, there's no approximation, except that there's something cute that you get the Coulomb gas in what in the tutorial we call this pixel picture, which is how do you describe a set of charged particles in a surface? You can describe by saying where are they? Where are their positions, and integrating over their positions. That's what we do there. We integrate over the positions, and we sum over how many particles there are. And for each number of particles, we integrate over the positions of the particles. And in the partition function, because they are indistinguishable, we would put a 1 over n factorial because they are indistinguishable. That's description number one. Description number two is you say, I have a screen, and it has white or black pixels. And if the pixel is black, there is a particle there. Right? So in that language, what are the positions? They are the positions of the pixels. So instead of having three positions when I have three particles, I have a million positions because they are the position of my pixels. And out of those million pixels, I say which three are on and which ones are off. And I say that three of the pixels are one, all other pixels are zero. And that's another way of describing where the particles are. So the same Coulomb gas integration over the position of where the particles are, I can do either by integrating over the positions of, say, 10 particles, or by saying that I have a million positions of a lattice. Out of those 1 million, 10 of them are 1, and the other 1 million minus 10 are 0. And the ones that are 1 tell me, it's like, where is the particle? Click. It's where it's on. Right? So it's like seeing a screen of a computer and identifying where are the particles. In that language, saying that this pixel is on and this pixel is on means that the particle is here and the particle is here. And there is no need for 1 over 2 factorial in that case, right? Because you just say it's the configuration where these two pixels are on. There is no other configuration. You are not overcounting anything, right? And you are describing exactly the same thing. So one language is the particles move smoothly in the continuous. In the other, pixels turn on where particles are. So it's like real life versus the matrix, right? In the matrix, the computer just says you are here, or now you are here, now you are here, but it's the same thing, right? We don't know if we are in the matrix, of course. All right? So, and what we get when this random surface, we go to the Coulomb gas, but we get the Coulomb gas in this pixel picture. And then the first problem of the tutorial was to ask to explain exactly what I just explained by words. That this pixel picture is describing the same thing, saying where the particle, saying that there is a particle here and a particle here, or integrating over the positions that will eventually pass there is the same thing. So you can describe the same configuration space. And then, so we have this beautiful set of three dualities and models related to this. And you could ask, are there interesting phase transitions in these models? Right? So is there a transition, for example, between a region where you have some magnetization, where all spins are pointing in the same direction, and another where you don't have magnetization? The answer is, to that question, no. We already said several times, no order. So there's no transition between the correlation function going to a constant at large distance and the correlation function going to zero at large distance. Going to a constant, remember, is what we get if we have magnetization, because Si Sj becomes Si times Sj, and then if there is magnetization, it goes to a constant. And when there is no magnetization, it goes to zero. This doesn't exist. It's not true. Of course, it could not be. We are in two dimensions. But no one forbids us from having other interesting things. We could have, for example, a behavior, which is what happens in this model, where there is a critical temperature, Tc, and here the correlation length of my spins, Si dot Sj, decays e to the minus the separation divided by some correlation length. And below this point, my correlation length, would decay as a power law, 1 over r, to some critical exponent mu that actually depends on t. And that for any t smaller than tc, there will be a difference, it will be a line of critical exponents. Okay. This indeed would be what happens here in this model. And you could have this very rich model. And what is the physics going on? What's the transition between the two? What is going on that separates this region where I have this exponential decay and this region where I have this power law decay? It's the fact of whether these vortex configurations, are they relevant or not? So there is a transition. You could ask, these vortices could appear. But what happens when I zoom out? I start with a model of vortices, right? And now I ask, are they important at large distances? Is large distance physics dominated by having many vortices? Or is it dominated by not having vortices at all? Or in this language of starting with vortices, what you could imagine happening is that you have a plasma, right? You just throw a bunch of charges, vortices and antivortices, and now we can have different states of matter. For example, the vortices and antivortices could form pairs and bind each other and give a neutral plasma. Or they could decide to just go and distribute homogeneously and form a plasma. So you could have different insulator versus conductor, you could have different behavior. And indeed, it's very much analog to confinement, and what could happen with this plasma is that, what does happen with this plasma is that there is a transition between discharged particles screening each other or not screening each other. In the spin language, it would be a transition between having vortices at large distances or not having vortices dominating at large distances. And in the surface, it would be the transition between a flat surface and a very rough surface. And all those physics of these three transitions, now we learn that because they are in the same universality class, if you know the critical exponents for the flat surface versus rough surface, you know the transition between this conductor and insulator in the 2D charged particles, and you know this transition between vortices and no vortices in the O2 model, which is the Kosterlitz-Toulouse transition, which was basically what gave the Nobel Prize to like 2 years or 3 years ago, was basically for the study of this transition. So it's a beautiful subject. So last year, if you are curious about knowing more, last year like half of the lecture was about the O2 model. So this year, I took out the O2 model to put the spin models, all this Ising model and so on. But there is a beautiful story about this O2 model. And last year, we really went into great detail into the XY model. So I have like maybe 2 weeks or a week and a half just on the XY model. If you want to learn more about this one, it's definitely a beautiful, beautiful model. So one thing, for example, that you can do is start with this Coulomb gas and do renormalization. Imagine I have a gas of charged particles, and we do renormalization. What does it mean? We say that I have these particles and antiparticles, these vortices, and there is a minimum distance that I don't go, because it's like we are in the lattice. So we don't go to a very short distance. This log doesn't blow up because I stay away from some cutoff, right? In other words, it's the answer to the question that was asked, that when I am very close, there is a lattice, so there's nothing blowing up. I have just some energy of 4 spins, which is of order 1. So I stay outside some cutoff. But then I could say I want to increase my cutoff and integrate out things and get an effective description with a new cutoff. Now, what does it mean when I increase the cutoff? When I increase the cutoff, I have to compute the effective coupling now between I and J. What is the new coupling between I and J? And then we have to do RG directly in this position space. And I believe this is going to be your next homework, right? Which is exactly working out this RG. And through this RG, you will write some RG equations, analyze the critical points, and see exactly this nice behavior that there is a line of critical points appearing rather than just one critical point like we saw before. So this was something that we did not have time to see. So I wanted to at least say a few words about what this XY model is. And the other thing that I also mentioned, the two other things, and I want to just repeat what I said, the two other things that we mentioned that we did not have time to study, which is also very cute, that I encourage you to have a look if you are interested in, is percolation. Percolation is another very beautiful set of models on the lattice, where at each position of a lattice, you also say it's either empty or full. And you can interpret it as saying I have a rock, and the rock can be porous, and it can be either empty or full. So I put water, and water can pass from one side of the other if there is an empty channel. But if there is no channel that goes from one side to the other, I cannot pass. So of course, you could imagine that it could also be related to some random walks of going or random domains and so on. And there is a beautiful study of those statistical models that would be relevant for oil drilling, right? You want to see what's the probability of giving a rock that I can pass oil from one side to the other, for example. And indeed, people in oil, they study this percolation, of course. And the other type of models that we said we could study, but we didn't have time, was models of disorder. For example, what would happen if I had a lattice that was random? Here the lattice was fixed. What would happen if my lattice was random? Or what would happen if my couplings were random? And that's also a beautiful subject. And in particular, the model of random surfaces, these random lattices, is related to what are called matrix models. And but that would take us a few lectures. I don't think there is a point in going into the technical details there. So yeah, percolation and disorder we left out completely. O2 model we did not leave out, but we mostly covered in the tutorials and in homeworks. And if you want to know more about O2, you can see the lectures from last year. Otherwise, I think I did what I promised in the first lecture. So I think we are good. Thank you. Oh, I have a t-shirt. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.